Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. And a special welcome as ever to all of our listeners on other community radio stations across Ireland. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, national and regional broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the November edition of Wireless, we go behind the scenes at the mid-morning programme at one of Ireland's local commercial radio stations, Clare FM. Research into diversity in community radio in Ireland and North America, more from the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive, and a look back at World College Radio Day 2020.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The mid-morning talk show has been the backbone of commercial local radio in Ireland over the past 30 years and was also a feature of some of the more innovative pirate stations of the 1980s. Today we go behind the scenes at one of the West of Ireland's leading mid-morning programmes, Morning Focus on Clare FM. County Clare's local station spills over well into Galway City and we're regular listeners. But how does the mid-morning slot function and how is the apparently seamless show put together every day? We caught up with Morning Focus presenter Gavin Grace to find out more.
Morning Focus, or a variation thereof, it was formerly called On a Clare Day. It's been at the heart of the Clare FM schedule since the station launched in September 1989, obviously well before my time. But as you'll be aware, John, when local radio started, these talk shows became, these mid-morning talk shows became the vehicle of choice to drive listenership, to discuss local issues and to set local radio apart. And I still think it's doing that to this day. In terms of my own involvement, I joined Clare FM in January of 2010, but that was as a news journalist. I subsequently worked as deputy news editor, and I've been hosting the programme since August of 2015. So just over 5 years, I've been a full-time host now.
And you are a news editor of Clare FM as well, isn't that right?
That's right, yes. So it's a very busy day, busy morning when you're planning your news output for the day, assessing events that have happened overnight and how they'll impact both your news bulletins and indeed the show itself.
So we'll come back maybe to the news angle later on and your role there, but sure. To come back to Morning Focus then, what are the programme's aims and how does it tie in with the kind of requirements that local radio has in terms of speech content?
It's a really good question and I don't know if I've got a distinct answer for it. I suppose there are a lot of aims in any programme, but to me, and it's a very obvious one, it's my intention that Morning Focus serves the people of Clare as best as is possible. And that involves discussing the issues that matter to the listeners at home. I also, to be frank, want the show to sound like the sort of show that I would listen to. I took over from John Cook, who was the previous host, a fabulous host who had been in the chair for about 11 years, I think, when he left. He's gone on to Radio 1 now. And I decided very early on that while I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that I would gradually shift the programme towards something that I was a little bit more comfortable with, interested in, and as a presenter, something that I could put my style on and my footprint on. We've done more sport, for example. It's something that I would be quite fond of. At the same time, I'm very conscious that there's an audience there that has been built up over, well, for now over 30 years, that I want to serve, and I would have a very strong ethos in, as much as we can, highlighting community events and positive community initiatives, reaching out as best we can, even in these strained times, reaching out to towns and villages all over Clare, telling people what's happening on their doorstep. And then all of those aims and ambitions, and a few more, including, you know, I've got a drive to try and hear some really interesting personal stories from people, and that's always been a big feature of the show. But all of that then gets mixed in together, and we aim for that every day. We don't always get to it all, but that's certainly the aim over the course of each morning.
So does this contribute significantly then to the requirement to have 20% news and current affairs between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.? Obviously, it's a big contributing factor to that. Would that be correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Indeed. Now, some of that is a bit above my pay grade. We do a comprehensive local news service as well as the show. And my understanding, and don't quote me on figures in this, John, my understanding is that we would be well in excess of the 20%. I would also argue, though, it's not just for regulations. I think that if that regulation was thrown out tomorrow morning, certainly in Clare FM and probably in every other local radio station, you would see the mid-morning talk show continue, because it's a big driver for listenership as well, you know. And to my mind, and I'm biased because I'm not a music presenter, but to my mind, the local content, the local speech content will always be, in news and sport, will always be the driver of audiences for local radio, because it's something that we can offer that is distinct and unique, and you won't get it anywhere else.
And how do you put it together then? There's a lot of different aspects to it, a lot of different segments, different styles, different themes and so on. So what's the template, or is there a template for how you balance the various elements?
There's a template at the end of the day, and I'll start there and then work forward. So when I left this evening, I had a fair idea, and I have a fair idea of what we will do on air tomorrow morning. But of course, from now until then, things could change. So I suppose the first part of the template is to react to and to reflect the breaking news stories that matter, and we had an experience of that today. I can get into it in a short while. You have your regular features. We traditionally try to do sport on a Monday. We have a regular vet slot, a regular GP slot. We have legal advice. Our dog warden is a popular local character, and he's had a slot in that program forever and a day. And then you try then to, I suppose, there isn't necessarily a template to the show, but you try then and give people what they're expecting. And for us, that has moulded into our hardest news items coming towards the top of the programme, and then our softest, lighter community events perhaps coming towards the end. But with little bumps along the way, you don't want it to be doom and gloom at the start of the show. But there's no one template. There's no... Things change, and people's availability comes into it as well. You know, if you can only get a minister for the second last slot in the programme, well, then that's when you'll do it. So, I don't know what a template be the right word with respect. There's a model, there's a framework, but it can change every day.
And is geography an issue, Gavin? Do you feel a need to cover all parts of the county, or is it just driven by the news agenda?
Primarily, we're driven by the news agenda, but geography is, of course, an issue. And it's our obligation, in my eyes, to ensure that when we're covering what's happening in County Clare, that we reflect what's happening in all of County Clare. Now, I'm fortunate, unlike some other local stations, that we have one county to focus on. But each town has its own identity. In some ways, different parts of Clare would have almost have different... Maybe not cultures, but certainly different approaches to life. West Clare is Gaelic football country. Mid and East Clare is hurling country. And there's only a small number of places where the two should meet in the main. But that's just an example. Sport, of course, isn't the only thing. But you do try to reach out. You do try to get to every area. And I said, look, it's a moral obligation. But, you know, from a business point of view, if you're going to get a... Whenever they come back, if you're going to get a JNLR survey and they land in a particular community and they ask the people there what they're listening to, then if you've been talking about them and if you've been speaking with people from that community, they're more likely to remember you than not. So there's an element of that to it as well. But it, that's not the driving factor, but it would be a very big mistake to ignore an area, I feel.
And would you have contacts all over the counties? Would you have people who would provide you with leads on stories or, you know, angles that you could cover? Or would you be going after people?
It's a bit of both, you know. But yes, you would have people in most, I would have people in most parts of Clare that if something is happening, I can pick up the phone and ring them and get a steer at the very least. But I mean, I'm blessed by the fact that I came into a station that was, whatever, 20 years old or thereabouts. So, you know, those contacts, a lot of them were there before I came. I've cultivated a few, of course. You continue to work on that as and when you can. But I mean, that's the role of any journalist.
You mentioned a news story that broke today, and I should say that we were recording this interview on the day that Ryanair announced that it was pulling out of Shannon and Cork for the winter. And I have to say that when I heard that on your programme this morning, I said, aha, it's going to be a very busy day for Gavin. How did that pan out in the end, and how did you cover it?
Okay, so it didn't come as a surprise, firstly. It's a temporary closure of their bases this winter. But Ryanair have been flagging this for a couple of weeks. Nonetheless, it's obviously very significant. Shannon Airport is the economic heartbeat of Clare, the Midwest, and beyond as well. So instantly when this came, you know it's going to be a big story. The first I heard of it was, although again it didn't come as a surprise, the first confirmation I heard of it was at approximately probably 25 past 7 this morning. And from then on, I have a producer, Rebecca, who's brilliant at what she does, and Fiona Cahill was working in our news at the time, so I'm liaising with them both in terms of how we will cover it in our different ways. So Fiona writes a news story, and I edit it before it's recorded and put to air. I speak with Rebecca then about the guests we're going to get on, and you just start ringing people, effectively. Got onto Ryanair, they wouldn't talk. The airport themselves issued a statement later that they haven't done an interview yet. I expect that to come tomorrow. But you're, I suppose, in an instant like that where you've got a breaking story, you're trying to get reaction. And then, of course, I mentioned a while ago, in the evening, I have an idea of what's coming tomorrow. You have to ring up a couple of people and say, I'm very sorry, but we're not going to get to your item today. And that's the nature of it. People, by and large, are understanding. There's an expectation from the audience that you'll cover all of these events, that you'll do so well, and unfortunately you have to throw out the bathwater every now and then to do so, but that's just a process you're very used to. Sometimes it happens during the programme. Another story that broke about 24 hours ago as we record this, of course, John, was the COVID restrictions were increased. So we had the ban on visits to homes, the level 4 restrictions as well in Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And while that's not necessarily the most relevant to Clare, it so happened that in a post-budget interview, I had Minister Heather Humphreys from County Monaghan on the programme this morning. So much as I'd love to say that one was, again, reacting to the story, sometimes you get a little bit lucky as well.
So in the 10 years that you've taken over the programme, Gavin, social media has powered ahead and is now a very serious challenge to traditional media. So how do you navigate that environment on a morning programme like your own?
It's a minefield, and I could write an essay about it because there's so many different ways in which it impacts what we do, and some of it's very obvious. You have to get your message out there. You have to be faster. You have to make sure that you are where people are, so you're on social media. But it makes it very hard to switch off from the job, if I'm honest. And it's one of the biggest drawbacks of it. I think, look, at from a media point of view, I haven't gotten too wrapped up in the challenge aspect of it, because I'm not gonna change anything by worrying about it too much. I think we just have to embrace it and go with it. We have a system where stories posted to our website are automatically tweeted. We have a system where we schedule stories to go up on Facebook. We promote the program on social media. We've just had to adapt and change, and if I'm honest, add to our work model, our workflow, and our workload just to keep up with it, basically.
And of course, another huge challenge in the last 7-8 months has been COVID-19. So yeah. Presumably, a lot of your work is now done remotely, or how often do you broadcast from Ennis these days?
I'm actually back in the studio. I'm more comfortable in the studio, to be honest with you. And for now, I think I can still continue that and safely. I mean, I have to give credit to Clare FM. We've put in a really comprehensive plan to ensure that all of us are safe. There's no issue with social distancing. We've installed a screen in the studio that's in between myself and my guests. And I know other stations haven't done that. They undergo temperature checks as well. We all do when we go into the building. So from that point of view, I feel safe in the studio. I did, and I'll continue to do some shows from home. And that never happened before COVID. And there's aspects of it I enjoy. The commute is much shorter to go from upstairs to downstairs. But I think you need to work with, I think in my job, you need to be able to work closely with a team. And when we had to be out of the office for that period in April in particular, it was frustrating. Aspects of it were certainly frustrating. So I was glad to get back there and look at, if COVID drives me out of it, we're prepared to go and do it again. But fingers crossed, I'll cross my fingers and hope against hope that doesn't come anytime soon.
And does Morning Focus drive the news agenda then itself a bit for Clare FM? Because you are head of news as well, and obviously there's a major news bulletin at lunchtime and again at 5 p.m. So to what extent does Morning Focus contribute to the news output of the station?
To a big extent, but that's important for any station, I think. I mean, your current affairs programme is your flagship show, so if you're bringing on your news makers, then what they say on your airwaves have to be news. So one feeds the other. You know, sometimes it's a very good news story that becomes the spark of a discussion item on the show. The two have to work hand in hand. I haven't got extensive experience working in another radio station's newsroom, but to me, it's certainly the best model. But not just in terms of workflow, because it obviously helps, you know, that you get two bites of a cherry out of an interview, shall we say. But if I can bring on a senior politician, for example, and talk to them about the news of the day, then their answers are news. So, it feeds it to a big extent. But the news has its own distinct identity and does its own work as well. It's a mix between both.
And what's your standout moments then, finally, over the last 10 years? What were you most proud of, or did you enjoy the most in all of the programmes that you presented on Clare FM?
Wow. I didn't get a chance to think about this, John, so thanks for putting me on the spot. I'll tell you one, and it's not necessarily the best piece that I've ever done, but it was one that I was very proud of. And there's a bit of a story behind it, so apologies, it'll take a couple of minutes. I have certain systems for searching for stories online that appear in different and strange parts of the internet. It's called Google. And one day on Google, I came across a news article from Coventry of a man by the name of Peter Keane. Now, I forget his exact age, but Peter was well advanced in years. And the article commemorated a story that I had never heard before. It was the 50th anniversary of he and a couple of others in an RAF troop who broke a world record for having the highest, at that time, the highest ever parachute jump. They jumped from about 8 miles, but they didn't have the technology of today. They were wearing effectively a boiler suit. With a couple of cardigans on to keep them warm, to take, you know, it's pure skinnier pants stuff. And I tracked Peter down, and through his son Chris arranged an interview, which I recorded one afternoon. And with respect to Peter, who I really got on with and was a really nice man, a lot of the interview couldn't be broadcast as a straight interview because stories went from here and there, but there was still this fascinating story in it. And I remember spending a lot of time almost thinking about it, but then working on it and trying to make this, you know, a really good broadcast piece. And eventually did some searching and found some almost sound effects to bring it to life and some music. And I think it's one piece that I was very proud of because I through those little bit extras that you wouldn't normally get in a talk show, I was able to bring people back to his time. There was a little Pathé newsreel talking about Boscombe Downs Air Base where it happened. There was wind effects as he was jumping from the plane, the sounds of the aircraft as well. And I remember when that went out, or before it went out actually, I remember just telling people in a kind of honest and genuine way, you always try and promote what's coming up in the programme. I remember saying to people, we're going to do this after 11 o'clock this morning. You know, make yourself a cup of tea and enjoy it. And I got some great feedback from it because it was something that I think the story was told well, not to toot my own horn, but if I look back on 10 years, that's certainly the highlight that comes to mind of a moment that I felt really proud.
Gavin Grace, presenter of Morning Focus on Clare FM, and you can listen in Galway from 9 to 11 a.m. on 96.4 FM or on clare.fm. The show is also repeated every evening at 11 p.m. and is available as a podcast.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Ireland has become a much more diverse place over the last 20 years with the arrival of immigrants from various parts of Europe and the world, but this sizeable percentage of the population remains underrepresented in most Irish media. Katie Moylan is an Associate Professor of Media at the University of Leicester who has researched this topic and published a book in 2014 called Broadcasting Diversity: Migrant Representation in Irish Radio. Katie is also currently a Marie Curie scholar exploring Indigenous radio in the US, so we caught up with her to discuss her research interests. First, she explained how she came to research diversity on Irish radio.
That book emerged out of my PhD research, and I decided on PhD research about 2003, 2004 initially. And why I hit on diversity in radio, in Irish radio, was because, as many of us will recall to different degrees, your students might remember it, you know, as smaller people. But with the Celtic Tiger, what you had in Ireland is kind of incoming of diversity and diverse communities, where previously Ireland really in the 90s and through the end of the 90s was pretty homogenous. So unlike other parts of Europe where diversity was in place, where you did have this kind of diversity in cities and that kind of cosmopolitan experience, what was happening in Irish media is it was kind of scrambling to represent these new communities thoroughly. And a lot of people were writing about television and representation and representation of migrants in, say, things like Fair City. But nobody was looking at radio. And so I started listening to how radio was addressing the new diverse listenership that was growing in Ireland. And then with RTE, RTE had a couple of programs which I write about. The first one was, you know, there's different voices, which really kind of took it into a more representative place because it was led by a guy called Guy Bertrand Nimpa, I should say. So that was a migrant practitioner producer, which was, you know, an experience which enabled a more thorough representation of some migrant communities because it spoke to that experience of being a new migrant in Ireland. But I did feel that RTE could have developed further programming, and that what happened then after a while is they developed a new program called Spectrum, but that was led not really by a migrant, but by someone, she was South African, so certainly she migrated to Ireland, as indeed did I, you know, previously, but she spoke from a situated perspective, which was kind of less of a migrant and more of a position of privilege. So I felt that RTE wasn't doing, that was one example in which I felt RTE wasn't doing enough to enable and to facilitate really full representation of what was already a diverse amount of communities in Ireland, you know, because you had incoming communities in different parts of Africa, you had the Polish communities, which came a little bit later, and you had Chinese communities coming a bit later, but you also had Spanish communities. It was diverse already and growing. But what was happening on the ground was that community radio was giving different community groups radio slots to produce more thoroughly developed programs, not just of, you know, being Spanish or being Romanian or being South African or being Nigerian, but about how it felt to be a migrant in Ireland. And those conversations were really only taking place, from what I could run into, from what I was researching and listening to, in community radio contexts. And really, my interest, my research interest in community radio has kind of grown from there.
And can you tell us about some of the examples then? I know that you covered Anna Livia FM, which is now called Dublin City FM, which had an interesting initiative in that area. How widespread were those type of programs on community radio at the time in the late 2000s, around the beginning of the last decade?
Well, it's interesting because I had a quick look there, John, at their schedules today at Dublin City Radio's schedule, and also Near FM. So those are both Dublin-based stations, of course. And Near FM was fantastic. Near FM was doing what was then called multicultural programming from really the mid-90s. So from recollection, they had a Spanish show from the late 90s, I think. The key to community radio provision of diverse programming is always in their schedules. What can happen is a community station will devote a particular slot in the schedule to, say, this diversity representation. So, for instance, Near FM, I had a quick look there before we spoke today, does three evening shows on different dates to three different communities. So there's one for Chinese communities, there's one for Russian communities, and there's one for Polish communities that I could see. Anna Livia seems, not Anna Livia anymore, excuse me, Dublin City. I'm actually going to call it up right here. It has a few shows, but I feel like there's perhaps greater provision for diverse communities back when I was writing, but that is not an empirical finding. That's just an impression I'm getting.
So did you feel at the time, did your research show that this was very much a policy decision on the part of the broadcasters themselves to invite immigrant communities to contribute, or was there a surge of interest from the ground going to these local community media outlets, so to speak?
I mean, of the two, I think the truth is, or you know, what was actually happening in these practices was somewhere in between. But I would say more the latter, in that in the given kind of neighborhoods, but also in listening communities for both Near FM and Anna Livia, as was, there was interest, yes, from the ground, because and as ever happens in community building, I think people came across, say, Anna Livia and said, oh, here is a venue, they might be interested in us doing a show. And then I did interview the two station managers to see, yes, indeed, was there a policy. But with community radio, a lot of this stuff tends to be quite organic. And we always have to be careful using terms like organic. It's like community. It's got so many connotations and they can be fuzzy and uncritical. But what I mean by organic in this context is that station managers for community-facing organizations, particularly community radio, they're just aware of what they're, like anecdotally in conversation, you know, what their regular listeners are listening to, what they're asking for. And so they respond in kind. It probably would come up in a meeting, and certainly decisions around when a particular slot, you know, should be allocated. So I looked at a show called African Seed, and that went out in the mid-evening, but then other examples of what was then called ethnic programming. So I think it was a mixture of the two.
Okay. And obviously community radio doesn't deal with the same kind of hard listenership data that we have for commercial radio in Ireland. So what sense did you get of the relationship between these broadcasters and their communities?
Well, see, what I loved about what I came across is that they had a phone-in capacity. So that's how we could track listening. Now, you're quite right, there's no empirical data, and that's because community radio stations remain very under-resourced, so they don't have the money spent on kind of that kind of research. But what was happening is on African Scene, for instance, which I include in the book, you had people calling into the show regularly. I remember, and this is in the book as an example, one of the callers was a regular caller. So the two hosts, Lizelle and TJ, they recognized him. They're like, oh, it's you again. And to me, that exemplifies a trust from other community members. Now you're talking about tiny amount of regular callers, maybe, I don't know, 10 or something. But not everyone feels like calling into a show, you know, so that's not necessarily representative of the numbers listening. But what I do think it really exemplifies is that kind of like reciprocal relationship in real time, because when callers were allowed on the show, they spoke at some length. So it was a real realized forum and actual discussion in ways that even public service broadcasters can't often facilitate, because they have more restrictions on their running order, for instance. So one of the great things about community radio is that a show has a lot more fluidity and flexibility, which in turn enables these longer conversations.
Okay, so you published another book last year called The Cultural Work of Community Radio, and this is an international comparison between different stations. You cover stations in New Orleans, in Miami, Montreal, Toronto, and also tribal radio. I'd like to come to the tribal radio in a moment, but first of all, what were your first impressions when you moved from the Irish context to community radio in other contexts? Were there connections? Were there huge differences? Were there commonalities there?
There are commonalities, but they're both. And I'd also looked at UK community radio as well, which is a very thriving sector. What continues to just really, I'm so struck by this always. Community radio has so many commonalities, and a lot of those are structural. So it is often the norm that a community radio station remains under-resourced. So you might have one or two salaried members. Everyone else produces and presents a show on a voluntary basis. And this is very interesting all by itself, because that means that people who do produce programs for community radio really have a genuine, they're really driven to make these programs. They love what they do, and that's why they do it effectively for free. And that's only one part of the commonalities they have. They usually have a nonprofit license, so there's usually, again, less advertisements, as I mentioned earlier. But these commonalities are in place in Ireland, in UK, in Canadian, and in US examples that I've seen. Where the differences come into play is, of course, dependent on the communities who are self-representing. And then there's a difference, too, between I look at individual standalone shows, which might be on a community station which represents different communities, such as Near FM. But I also look at standalone stations which are dedicated to a single community, such as the Haitian station in Miami, where they represent members of the Haitian community, which is sizable in Miami. So in those senses, those programs and that programming is very distinct. So to use the Miami example, they do their programming in both Haitian Creole, some in French, but a lot of it in English as well. But they cover different experiences of, say, what's of interest to Haitians in Miami, everything from sport to Haitian film to French film, and then current events. So it's very specific to the region that they are representing, but also specific to what is of interest, for instance, to Haitians in Miami. There's a lot of talk about Haitian food in Miami, for instance, and where to find it. I can give other examples as well of that specificity. But effectively, any community, especially marginalized communities that move to a big city, so I found this in Toronto, I found this in Montreal, but also in places like New Orleans, where there's a sizable Vietnamese community there. They're speaking from their memories and their shared experiences of Vietnam, for instance, their home country, but also of the city that they have found themselves in and how to negotiate that, such as things like food, like I mentioned with the Haitians, but also events which are, you know, for and by that community. In places like Montreal or Toronto, it's kind of, these are both recognized diverse places. So to be a member of that community, you know, you want to kind of like know about events that are special for your community, but also maybe about other otherwise, you know, marginalized communities and kind of what's happening across the city in your experience.
So you're doing ongoing research then on tribal radio. Is this just in the US or also in Canada?
Well, that's a good question. The fellowship is to focus on the U.S. And I can't tell you, I'm still very much in the research stage of this, but there's so much here to explore, John. And I was led to this when I was finishing up the book that you talked about, Cultural Work of Community Radio, because I realized you couldn't look at community radio examples in U.S. contexts without seeing what was happening with indigenous or tribal radio. Because this number is still, you know, it's still not 100% nailed down, because data on this isn't, you know, again, it's an under-resourced sector, but apparently there's somewhere between maybe 45 to 50 to 70 tribal radio stations across the 50 states of the U.S. So that's a lot of standalone stations. But tribal radio, and by that I mean radio on individual reservations, so Hopi radio or Navajo or Diné radio, is what I mean by tribal radio, and indeed tribal practitioners define what they do often as tribal radio. So of tribal radio station on a reservation space has to do so much more work again, because it is the first point of call for communication for its tribal communities, which means it's the first port of call, certainly now during COVID, for information that's community specific. And this is for, say, elder members of the population who might not have good internet connectivity, so they access the radio through the antenna, through the analog. Or for younger members, can still access it online, because I should say that one amazing development for all community radio has been the development of reliable streaming technologies. This has revolutionized community radio, because it does mean that you can ideally access any station that has a streaming platform around the world. So a very localized Hopi radio station can now be accessed around the world, and I find that extraordinary. So Reservation Radio Tribal Radio has an emergency response capacity. It's the first point of call for a lot of news. And during COVID, its use for the community and its community building is so essential, because localized information, everything from testing availability to grocery store openings to openings for elders, and all of this is really acute, urgent information that people are getting really with that radio station, often as a first point of call. But also these stations are doing the usual community building work that I talk about. So they're doing a lot of first language tribal radio programming, where this is kind of a mixture between a kind of preservation function, where they're making sure that the language is still in use. So for the Hopi station, they'll have Hopi programming. And that station, by the way, is KUYI. You can find it if you do a Google, and you can find it on radio.garden, as you can many of the other stations that broadcast as tribal stations.
Very good.
Yeah, I know. It's a fantastic resource. So some of the cultural programming that I find really fulfills a community building role is this first language programming, is the retelling and rebroadcasting of established stories of the tribe, but also some kind of more subtle and really, really tribally specific practices like seasonal broadcasting. So KUYI does a very specific way of relating information depending on the time of year that we're in. So some information, it's considered that you can't relay all the information explicitly at certain times of the year. For Hopi specific reasons. So instead they relay information in a kind of, they allude to things instead, and this is understood by listeners. Says, I find that such a value, because it means that it is working as media ideally should, you know, of and for the people that it's, you know, made for, made with these people in mind, and in ways that resonate completely to their experience. Given that radio was developed to kind of, it was really turned into a medium that was a one-way purveyor of information. But it's always had this capacity to be a greater, a more fluid medium than that. And so aesthetically and politically, as well as culturally, I find the work of many of these tribal stations that I've seen to just, there's a lot of in-depth community building there across these different cultural functionalities, as well as the more urgent information provision that we're seeing now with COVID-19.
Katie Moylan, Associate Professor of Media at the University of Leicester, speaking about her research on Indigenous radio in North America and diversity in Irish radio.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
As regular listeners to this program know, we're also involved in the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive, pirate.ie, and we've just finished a long series on the pirate history of the northeast of Ireland between 1978 and 1988. We've also released a new podcast, which is now available on our blog, and we hope to produce regular episodes covering various aspects of Ireland's exciting pirate radio past. We now bring you a flavour of what's in our online archive at pirate.ie, giving a sense of the diversity of that period. We begin with a snippet from the Dublin Super Pirate Radio Nova in 1983, at the time of Ireland's first abortion referendum. This is followed by an announcement by the Irish Christian Broadcasting Service, a Catholic station which also took a keen interest in the vote. Then we hear a promotion for community radio broadcast by Bray Local Broadcasting in County Wicklow. This is followed by a jingle for Boyneside Radio, one of the leading regional stations in the country. And then we hear the inimitable John the Man Frawley of Radio Limonee in Limerick, one of the great characters of local radio outside Dublin. And finally then we hear the iconic voice of Bob Gallico reading the news on the Dublin station Energy 103.
This is Pirate.ie.
That's the financial report courtesy of Comex Commodity Brokers on 608 977.
Radio Nova.
Hello, good evening and welcome. I'm Sybil Fennell. This is Dublin Today on Radio Nova 828 AM. Over on 88 FM, by the way, the rock show has just begun for alternative radio listening. But here on Dublin Today, between 9 and 7.30, we'll be looking at the split in Fianna Fáil over the amendment issue. Our studio guests will be City Councillor Michael Donnelly and rank and file member Alan Graham. Gig Guide will have details of what's on entertainment-wise around town. And we hear about Ireland's first CND peace camp at Mount Gabriel. Don't forget, if you have any comments to make about tonight's programme, our Dublin Today phone number is 604.
You are in tune now with the Irish Christian Broadcasting Service. It's Saturday morning once again, and Jim Sherlock was with you from approximately 8.30, and Jim went home at 10 o'clock, and I took over from 10, and I'm going to be here with you until 12 o'clock. And then from 2 to 3.30, I'll be back with you this afternoon. And I'm going to have an interview this afternoon with a young lady from America. And, well, all I can say about this is that if you have the time, just please listen in this afternoon, because I think what this lady has to say will be of some importance to each and every one of us in the decisions that we make next Wednesday when we go to cast our vote.
It's convinced that there is a need for local radio, that community radio can be of a great service to the local people.
We've been pressing for many years for improvement and enhancement at every level in radio.
Different people have different views as to the form local radio should take.
A lot of people in this area are now aware of what community radio means.
In the end, in my view, it's the listeners who will dictate what form local radio takes, not the legislators, but the listeners.
I believe that nobody has the right to say we are the only people who can decide who can broadcast.
Competition will do RTE good, and it will also do the provincial press good.
Sure, yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Shout to the top for community radio.
We got it, the great sound of today. Bubbling Boyneside Radio, in touch with you.
Dear August Muragwis, August Falta, hold on. Fierce lout. I was thinking there was something wrong. No, her grand. Dear August Murug with August Falta. Quig Radio Limni. God and Mary be with you on this lovely morning. And welcome to Radio Limni. Tis Wednesday, not Monday. Tis Wednesday, the 20th of April. Tis 26 and a half minutes to 8 o'clock.
Oh. Awesome. Energy 103.
Independent radio news at 1 o'clock with Bob Gallico. Good afternoon. The Atomic Energy Authority in Britain has denied that it withheld crucial information from experts about a fire.
This is pirate.ie.
Some clips from the Irish Pirate Radio audio archive, and you can hear more and check out our new podcast at pirate.ie. And finally, World College Radio Day was celebrated last month, and as ever, we got involved here at Flirt FM and linked up with other student radio stations around the world. Our station manager, Paul Lahealy, spoke to the person who launched the event, Rob Quick of WPSC at William Paterson University in New Jersey.
Thanks for talking to me, Paula. It's been a strange journey, but it's been one that has happened entirely because I love the medium of radio. And at Oxford, I was part of a group of students that launched the first ever student FM radio station in England, and I think the UK. It was really amazing. They told us that we couldn't do that. And then when we didn't give up and we won the license and then we did actually launch, that was an amazing experience. I was actually one of the first DJs on the air with my friend Damien. to go live. And we had a band at the time who launched with us called Reef. I don't know if you heard of Reef. Yeah. And they launched with us in 1997. And they came and they did a special appearance. And it was really an amazing experience to have that band. And then I was kind of hooked at that point. And then I really thought to myself, you know, I really do love radio. And I did do radio professionally because I went into commercial radio in the UK for a while. And I was actually really happy doing that. But my wife is American. And what happened was she was homesick and she really wanted to go back to America. And I said, well, look, if you go back, I'm going to have to start my career again in radio. And so I started in college radio and actually in Chicago. And there was this tiny station in Chicago that I took over called WXAV that was actually, they told me when I took over, they said, you've got like 2 years to make a difference. Otherwise, we might even shut this down or sell it off. And you've really got to do something with it. Within 2 years, we actually turned it around and we actually started winning awards. And it was really quite an amazing story. And then from Chicago, I ended up applying for a job in New Jersey. Similar sort of situation, actually, where I got this job and they said the radio station, William Patterson University, is in really bad shape and, you know, you've got to do something with it, otherwise we might not continue it. And we turned it around and then and actually we ended up winning at that station the biggest award you can get in America is the Marconi Radio Award. And it's like, the movie moment going to up against all
like
these major stations.
Station that could and turn and wins.
And so we won Best Non-Commercial Radio Station of the Year. And you might say, well, how big of a deal is that? We were up against radio stations. Our budget is $10,000 a year, really, to buy equipment and stuff after the bills are paid. And we're up against stations who had $10 million, $20 million a year. Right. So we pulled off some remarkable stuff. But it was during that time that I thought maybe we could do something and maybe we could celebrate college radio beyond just my station and maybe we could do something bigger.
So let me see. In 2011, you decided that working in radio, you weren't quite busy enough because everybody who volunteers and who works in radio pours their life into it. You decided, I need more of a challenge. Tell me, how did the idea for College Radio Day and then World College Radio Day come to mind?
Yeah, so basically I was watching that film, I think in December 2010, The Social Network, which was about, you know, the founding, the beginning of Facebook. Not that I was looking to do Facebook, but just to come up with an idea, I thought surely there's a way that we can come up with an idea to unite student radio stations, or college radio as they call it over here in America. Surely there's something we could do that could bring us together. And I went to bed next morning with the idea sort of fully formed when I woke up of College Radio Day. Surely, though, that's been done before. And so when I looked into it, when I started Googling it, I realized that no one's done that. And I thought, well, it's obviously such an obvious thing to do. So I didn't have much time for that first one in 2011. And again, I wasn't thinking beyond the USA because obviously living here now in the United States, so I was thinking obviously USA. I thought if we could get 50 stations to sign on with 3 months to go to until the date in October, 50 stations would be a good goal to have. And we put it out there and actually we ended up having over 360 stations within 3 months sign up. And it was a bit bonkers because I had the New York Times, Washington Post and USA Today, which is a national newspaper here, doing interviews with me saying what's going on and how, you know, uniting American college radio stations, what's that about? And isn't it time to do this? And what are you fighting for? And what's the point? So really, it resonated from year one. Got some really good publicity. And then I found myself very quickly talking to various artists and because a lot of bands and artists and musicians, successful ones, really do owe a lot to student radio. I mean, a lot of them really started out, playing and at and getting their music played on college radio stations. So I found myself spending the morning with Coldplay back in 2011, Chris Martin and all that. And he was really hugely supportive. The whole band was supportive of us. And then we were sort of off to the races because once you get Coldplay with you, and at that time, they were not the behemoth that they are now, obviously, but they still were big. And when we got them on, that gave us credibility. And suddenly we are now credible and we're legitimate, and the media started to really pay attention. And also, you know, what came out of that was World College Radio Day, and that was never foreseen by myself. The first College Radio Day, we actually had Jamaica and Canada join in, which was not something I ever foresaw. But really, the next year, I was contacted by an Italian woman called Tiziana, who's involved in Italian College Radio, and Guillermo in Colombia, who's in charge of college radio stations down there. And they said, hey, let's get together and let's kind of do World College Radio Day. And that's when it started to get bigger and bigger. And suddenly you've got 43 countries and hundreds of student radio stations. I mean, it's fairly bonkers, really. So I went from managing one radio station to suddenly being involved on a national and then global scale.
I think it does your heart good when you know that you have that solidarity going. Over the last 10 years, though, can you think off the top of your head, I don't know if other people have asked this before or whether you're going to have to dig, can you think of any lowlights, any struggles that you've had, and then conversely, any huge highlights or any like real milestones that you just remember over the first 10 years?
Yeah, so basically, very early on, we realised that we wanted to be a cause for good, that we wanted to be a non-profit, that we wanted to form as a proper charity. Because I realised that a lot of college radio stations are just, they have no money, their budgets are non-existent or very poor. And so actually, very early on, I decided to go down the path of establishing this as a proper non-profit. And we did that. Incorporated in New Jersey, tax exempt and all that. But here's what happened. So I'm really glad you asked me that, Paula, because when we did College Radio Day, we captured the imaginations of a lot of people, and we got really big. The perception of us is that we were very big very quickly, and that we were very legitimate, and particularly as we launched as a charity. I mean, we were invited. We got to go to the White House twice, and Obama presented us with a letter recognizing College Radio Day and everything. You know, I got to interview Vice President Biden at the time. So when you have all that kind of success and you have, you know, major celebrities and artists endorsing you, we had Sean Lennon, we had Moby, we had the late Avicii, who recorded a lovely liner for us, and we hoped to do more with him, but obviously he passed, unfortunately. But when you have quite significant names, household names endorsing you, there is a sort of perception that builds up, right, that, well, they're doing well for themselves. They couldn't possibly need any help from us financially. When actually, when it came down to it, none of us have ever been on salary, and we are doing this in our spare time outside of our normal day jobs. And so the perception was, when we started asking people for money, we're like, well, you've got all these big names, surely you're fine. And that hasn't been the case at all. Actually, you know, this year we're hoping to raise, well, we're giving away $10,000, US dollars, and actually more than that, much more than that we're hoping to do. But the perception always was, because we were so, in one sense, massively successful, going to places and opening doors and talking to people that were quite significant, that we actually are doing very well financially as an organization. That was actually not true at all. So that was a real struggle.
I think that's something that a lot of student radio stations would struggle with. The more professional they sound, the more well-funded they sound, and the more that they're pitted against their commercial competitors or somebody else in the area. So it's on a different level. I can completely understand that. And I have seen that happening with us. They're like, wait, you're not a commercial, or are you a pirate? It's really hard to know. And they're like, you've got loads of money because you sound good. And you're like, we sound good because we work really hard. So,
right, the perception. Exactly. Yeah, and so yeah. People think that you have the resources that you don't, the resources. And we didn't. In fact, I think what we've actually pulled off the last 10 years has been sort of, maybe this is a bit ridiculous, but sort of borderline miraculous, considering the fact that we've done it on a shoestring budget, on almost non-existent budget, and that it's entirely volunteer driven. And we have, I mean, like when you get a letter from the president of Italy, right, endorsing you, you're like, what's going on? I mean, this is like in a good way. And you know, I got early on, the governor of New Jersey did this statewide proclamation, you know, and I got this big scroll with the embossed seal on. And we got all the New Jersey House of Representatives. They also passed a resolution in support of College Radio Day. So it's, and then you got various governors going around the country in the USA passing resolutions of support and issuing proclamations, and obviously getting I think we got three letters from Obama in the end. Never got anything from Trump, but That's life, you know. Not complaining necessarily, but anyway, so there is that perception that we've done really well, and so we must, we don't, because we've done so well, we must be good, well off financially. And that's not true. And the organisation, the College Radio Foundation, which is what the charity is called, is a bit like College Radio itself, doing fantastic work, life-changing work, but perhaps doesn't get the recognition or the financial support that it really needs.
Well, let me tell you, Rob, that nobody goes into student radio for the short hours and the high pay, for sure. Next up, because it's the 10th anniversary, what's the biggest change that's come about in college radio, student radio, over the last 10 years, do you think?
Oh, I think because students have become, and college radio stations have become far more adept at using now the technologies available to them, social media, and you know, during this very, it's been a tough time, isn't it? This coronavirus has affected everything, but what you have seen and what I have seen, not just in the USA but around the world, is that students, where there's a will, there's a way, and the students have used all the technology that they can to remotely broadcast from their homes, from their houses, radio shows on their radio stations, because it's really important that college radio stations, student radio, has not fallen silent during this time. There would be the temptation just to shut everything down and to go silent. But that actually, what's needed is exactly the opposite. Now's the time actually to connect with people. A lot of people have found this a very stressful time. A lot of people have been locked down. So many people alone, on their own. And radio is the medium that has always been the most intimate medium, that has brought people together, that when you listen to the radio, you really feel a connection with the person who's broadcasting, who's talking into the microphone. And so I feel that students have really, in the last 10 years, you've seen them be very savvy and really adapted and utilised a lot of these great free tools that are out there to create great content. And I've always had this belief that it doesn't happen all the time, but I have witnessed firsthand what can happen when students have their, have the opportunity to have their creativity unleashed. And sometimes students can produce material and content that is as good as, if not better, than those who work in radio professionally. I've seen this firsthand. I had a student of mine who essentially produced a, I had a student of mine produce a radio documentary in my radio class that I teach at my university. About domestic abuse, domestic violence. And it was really one of the most powerful things I've ever heard. And she mentioned in this piece, she revealed that she had been abused in a relationship. And so she played this to our class, and we were all stunned, and she was very emotional because it's a very personal thing, creating radio. And I said, you've got to enter the, how do you feel about entering this to the National Student Awards, Radio Awards in the USA? And she goes, well, I don't think it's very good. And a lot of students really don't rate themselves at all, which is a shame. I said, I think this is worth submitting. So we submitted it in the category of best radio documentary, and they announced she was a top five finalist in the country. And then she won first place.
Yes.
She won this trophy, and then she had this trophy. She came back into the station after the awards, like with us. She couldn't believe it. Because of that award, she got a job interview after graduation and now works in media.
Rob Quick telling Paula Healy about World College Radio Day 2020. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Wireless on Flirt FM. Join us again in December for the next show. I hope you can join us then. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/Wireless Flirt. You can also listen to previous shows on wirelessflirt.radio.ie, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.